Well, I'm here with Michael Roth. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
So you are the president of Wesleyan University and also a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Are there any other hats you wear that I'm not aware of?
Well, I'm a grandpa and a dad and husband, and those are the main things right now. I teach every semester still at Wesleyan and try to write books for mostly academic audiences, but more recently trying to broaden my reach.
Yeah. So what do you teach? What is your intellectual and academic background?
So I'm a historian. And I was, as a student at Wesleyan, I couldn't make up my mind between history, philosophy, and psychology. And I had a fairy god dean, as I describe him now, who was a substitute dean. That's the best kind. And at the time, he said to me, "Why decide, man?" Mm-hmm. And he allowed me to
What year was that accent from?
1976. Uh-huh. I remember the ferns in his office. I think they were ferns. And Charlie, Dean Charlie, and so we made up this major there called History of Psychological Theory, which I thought was I was getting away with something. And as it turned out, for the next 40 years, I worked on history, psychology, philosophy. So it turned out to be right. But as I left his office, he said, "You ought to go to California, man." Mm-hmm. And I had never been west of the Poconos, so from growing up in New York. And so I drove, my girlfriend and I drove to California that summer. I bought a tent and then couldn't really decide always between philosophy and history, especially. So I became an intellectual historian.
Nice.
And my work has been on history of philosophy and psychology over the years. I did my senior thesis at Wesleyan was on psychoanalysis and politics. And that became my first book, and then it became an exhibition at the Library of Congress. And then most of my work is in the scholarly world was about how people make sense of the past. So things about memory and historiography and how people deal with trauma. And then since I've been at Wesleyan, I've written a few books on liberal arts education and freedom of speech and safe spaces and things like that.
Nice. Well, many of that, those ideas and areas of expertise will be brought to bear on the conversation we're going to have today, I imagine. I don't know how deep into the history of ideas we need to go, but certainly the recent history of ideas will be relevant. Well, so let's begin with the very broad question. How are things in the ivory tower these days?
Oh, it's terrible. You know, I've been teaching undergraduates since 1983 on my own, I guess even before that as a TA. And I don't remember a time of such trepidation, of really angst about government intervention, and at the same time, a kind of reluctance by students and even by faculty and certainly by administrators to stand up for the things we've claimed to believe in for the last 20 years or so. So it's a very odd feeling these days. We worried for the last dozen years or so about illiberalism from the left, especially. Many people have worried about that. Although I see myself on the left, I also worried about that. But that, to me, has nothing in way of comparison to the authoritarianism that is now being marshaled against freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry, freedom of expression by the federal government. And so that's terrible. But what really bothers me more than even than that, which bothers me a lot, is the reluctance of my colleagues to stand up for some basic freedoms that we until very recently took for granted. Mm.
Well, I definitely want to talk about the creeping authoritarianism and the capitulation of the institutions. But before we jump into that, what are the legitimate concerns about the ideological capture of American universities by the far left and far left ideologies? I mean, there's this intersection of, you know, what is often goes by the name of wokeness, you know, what I would call a kind of social justice, moral panic in certain areas, also a kind of quasi Marxist ideology, perhaps informing that, and an oppressor oppressed ideology that has been mapped onto the protest movement around animated the protest movement around October 7th. What is the most charitable construal of the concern around all of that that many people, I think we're going to demur here, but I think many people think the Trump administration is simply just acting on that concern. It's just gone too far. There's been this leftist takeover of elite institutions and a resulting degradation of the quality of thought there, certainly ethical thought, political thought. What can you say in defense of that concern?
Not much. I mean, to me, that's akin to saying that, you know, Putin has legitimate concerns about the Ukrainian threat against Moscow, that, you know, the Ukraine could have joined NATO and Russia would have been imperiled, or the Russians don't, you know, they have legitimate historical concerns in what is called the Ukraine or the Ukrainian entity, to use the. So I think it's vastly overblown. Mm. I think ideological capture itself is a misnomer. It doesn't really describe what's happened at most colleges and universities, where the most popular majors remain economics and psychology. The most popular professions are, the most desirable professions, especially at the elite schools, are in finance, or people wanting to go to Wall Street so they could work for a private equity firm that could buy, let's say, a group of podcast entities like yours. I mean, this is not neo-Marxism. This is not progressivism. It, you know, the danger in higher education is more vocationalism. So I think that it's important to not give in to the demands of the aggressor, just because there are some worries that people who thought they were on the left have.
So then, Michael, let me just take you back. So again, leaving aside the obvious maliciousness and malignancy of the response to this from the Trump administration, let's just talk about the problem. I mean, I remember first being alarmed by all of this when I saw Nicholas Christakis in the quad at Yale being hounded by a group of students who, not all of whom, but certainly several of whom, to my eye, were violating every norm of basic sanity on a college campus, short of punching Nicholas in the face. I mean, there was a none too implicit threat of violence there at some point. I mean, it was not clear to me that he could have safely left that crowd at a certain point without having to physically force his way past students. Those students got awards for their social justice activism, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, they also got death threats, because the reason you're aware of this is because it was filmed
right.
by people who wanted to make propaganda out of that, and they did so very successfully. I wrote to Nick Christakis right after that and said, you know, this is horrific. I'm so sorry this happened. I don't know him, actually. We've met more recently. So I don't disagree that that behavior was awful. But it would be like saying, I don't know, go to a fraternity party and see people vomiting and saying, oh, American universities have been, there's an ideological capture by, I don't know, the alcohol industry. I mean, this is idiotic behavior at Yale, where most people are trying to get good jobs on Wall Street, not destroy the system of free speech and liberal democracy. It was bad. I think it was, the folks behaved badly, and there was much too much tolerance for bad behavior on the part of colleges and universities. I think that's true, but I don't think that's a serious concern. I do think there was a serious concern about the lack of ideological or even intellectual diversity in the faculty at colleges and universities. And I've, you know, been writing about this for a long time. And I do think that's a serious problem, and it's getting worse in many respects, because folks aren't even going to graduate school if they're moderates or conservatives, in especially humanities and social sciences, interpretive social sciences. And that just is a narrowing of education, narrowing of the kind of questions asked. So I see that as a real problem. I think like the Yale example, which is now, 10 years old?
Yeah.
Or 8 years old, or the Charles Murray at Middlebury example. These are bad things, but, you know, Charles Murray probably gave 100 lectures beyond aside from that one, and which went without incident. So I just don't want to take those examples as exemplifying something much broader than it seems to me they merit being used for. I do think that the faculties at schools like mine have paid too little attention to ensuring intellectual and ideological diversity in the departments where that would really make a big difference, like mm-hmm. the humanities and interpretive social sciences. And it's hard to know exactly what to do about that. We've tried some things at Wesleyan with very small successes here and there, but that seems to me a real problem. When protests get out of hand, I don't see that as big a deal as some of my friends do or some of my colleagues do. It did seem to me that for a lot of people who thought of themselves as liberals, or at least moderates and liberals, to be outflanked by young students who demanded things we didn't think were reasonable, that was upsetting to people. But that's kind of what happens as you get older. Young people ask you to do things that are dumb from your perspective. You don't have to do them. And I think when the schools actually stood up to protesters appropriately, acknowledging their right to protest but not to harass people, I think things actually worked out pretty well at most schools. So the Yale example is a bad one. And there are probably, you know, 24 other examples we can come up with.
Mm-hmm. But well, I want to talk about the protests and what you recommend there, because my understanding is that Wesleyan navigated the moment post October 8th slightly differently than campuses like Columbia or UCLA or I forget the others that really had a problem. But before we do, so just on the point of viewpoint diversity that you just brought up, is there any daylight between you and someone like Jonathan Haidt or Steven Pinker? I mean, both very popular academics who've been fairly voluble on the need here to somehow recruit people who are politically right of the 10% mark on the left-right political continuum?
Well, I think Jonathan and I have worked together over the years on this issue. And though we don't always see things the same way, I'm one of the few people who gave a mixed review to the Coddling of the American Mind book. Mm-hmm. But I do agree with him that bringing more ideological diversity into the university's faculty is really important. And I called in, I think, 2010 or something like that. Well, no, 15, I guess, for an affirmative action program for conservatives in colleges and universities, which pissed off everybody, really. I mean, the left
even the conservatives?
Oh, especially because they said, we don't need affirmative action. We just need, you know, merit. But I actually think we had to be very intentional about hiring libertarians, people with strong religious faith that was related to their scholarship, and traditional conservatives. And I do think it's really important. I was made aware of this by a trustee at Wesleyan who became a friend, who just kept pointing out to me all the ways in which things that seemed normal to me, if you didn't share that ideological perspective, they were incredibly biased. And mm-hmm. so it's one of those moments where you say, oh my gosh, I am really biased. And so I need to correct for that. I mean, I teach Aquinas. I haven't converted to Catholicism, but I can teach Aquinas, but they shouldn't only have Jews from Long Island teaching Catholicism. They should have people who have lived experience, I think. And as much as you can. And so I've tried to hire people from the military. I've hired people with different points of view than the standard graduate from an Ivy League humanities department. And I think that when I started this, there was a lot of skepticism, to put it mildly, from my colleagues at Wesleyan and elsewhere. And now it's a robust conversation on campus about ideological bias. And that to me is really as much as I should do as the president. I mean, I should get people to be more aware of their biases, and then they're good people. They're professionals. They don't want to be acting with bias. And so I think there's been some correction. It could be greater. It could be, and I think that is a real issue.
My understanding is that there were, I can only imagine we're past this point now, as the shadow of the Trump administration imposed itself over all of our universities. But in the not too distant past, prospective hires or new hires were having to sign effectively, DEI pledges of some kind, right? They had to, I forget the actual verbiage, but it was something like, I'm committed to, even if their discipline was, mathematics, is I'm committed to, rooting out, racism in my field or whatever it was. You didn't see that as a kind of systematic way of filtering for and against the very people you would otherwise want to recruit?
Oh, I do think those were bad ideas. except when what you were trying to do is to make sure that somebody was able to teach a classroom of people from diverse backgrounds. That seems to me perfectly reasonable. Mm. In other words, we want to have professors or teachers who are able to teach a classroom with people who have different lived experiences, come from different backgrounds. That seems to me perfectly legitimate concern. If I'm hiring a crackerjack computer scientist who just is used to teaching in graduate school, other graduate students or very, you know, high-end majors at a great school, and you put them in a classroom at a public university where people come from various backgrounds, you want to make sure that they're able to deal with that. I mean, as a teacher, you have to adjust to the people in front of you and then have them adjust to you. Mm. So I think that's reasonable. But this idea that you would really want someone to make an ideological commitment to a program of diversity in order to teach math or history or whatever, that seems to me reprehensible.
Mm-hmm. So where is the actual line here? Because I mean, obviously, no university would want to recruit a professor who is a closeted or you know, out of the closet neo-Nazi. So there's some part of the ideological spectrum that is disqualifying from the point, yes, of view of, you know, you don't want the brand damage, you don't want the influence on your kids. I mean, why would you want a neo-Nazi teaching history or anything else at your university? But by the same token, why would you want a Hamas supporter? Why would Columbia want a professor who is an unabashed supporter of a death cult masquerading as a group of freedom fighters? Where's the line there for you?
So I think that a university shouldn't hire someone who is an active supporter of a terrorist organization. So I think that's, to me, that's pretty clear. Someone who is an opponent of the occupation or of violence, that seems to me that wouldn't be disqualifying. But I do think it would be disqualifying to hire someone, whether they were, let's say, a radical anti-Zionist or a radical Zionist, who thought their job in the classroom was to have more people like themselves. I mean, I think that's just disqualifying, because that's not what your job is as a teacher, is not to say convert people to your view, whatever your view is. But to the question, like how broad the spectrum should be of opinion, I have a terrible answer, which is that's a pragmatic issue. There is no formula for that. I don't want a Nazi on my campus. And someone says, well, you say you're in favor of free speech. Do you have limits to your support for free speech? I do have limits. And those limits are defined really sociologically or historically. There's not a formula for it. But I do think it's illegal in the United States. I know it's illegal in the United States to give material support to a terrorist organization. I think it should be illegal. Mm-hmm. And I would not want those supporters teaching in my university. There are times when you find out later on that somebody teaching whatever. I mean, they could be teaching, let's say, math, and they actually are strong supporters of Hamas because they feel it's not what you described as a death cult and a terrorist organization. I would agree with your description, but they have a different view of it. I think that as long as they're teaching math, that's really not my business what their idiotic views about politics are. Lots of people, in my view, have idiotic perspectives on politics. When they bring them into the classroom in a way that discriminates against students or harasses students, then I think they should be fired.
Mm-hmm. Is the line different for a guest speaker? I mean, if you have a student group that wants to bring in a controversial speaker, how do you handle that? And what is the Overton window wider in that regard?
I think it's wider. But again, I have this wishy-washy answer. I mean, it's a pragmatic. I don't think there's a formula for it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Years ago, before the word woke was used, we had Antonin Scalia was invited to give a talk at Wesleyan. We have a free speech series, and I was asked to invite him. And I thought the faculty were kind of baiting me to see like if I would not accept their recommendation, because they were to the left of me. And I thought Justice Scalia had done more harm to the interpretation of the American Constitution than almost anyone since the 1800s. But they're the committee that recommends someone. He's a Supreme Court justice, you know. I invited him. I also thought he'd say no because he's a Supreme Court justice. He's busy. He wrote back immediately. He said, I'd love to come to Wesleyan. And he mentioned that Larry Lessig had been there, who, of course, is quite far on the left, but had clerked for him. And Lessig had a great experience at Wesleyan. So I said, okay, he's coming. Now, if I hadn't invited him, I would have protested. I wouldn't have protested like to sort of stop him from speaking, but I would have stood outside with a sign saying, you know, Justice Scalia is a bad guy or something, you know, something dumb. And but instead, I had to invite him. I had to introduce him because I issued the invitation. That was the force. So I did that. And he gave a good talk. He spent the whole day on campus meeting with students. There were protests here and there, not to keep him from speaking, but just to acknowledge that they were against the work he had done as a Supreme Court justice. And we had it was actually a great day on campus. I allowed myself a reference to a critic of his in my introductory comments. He's the only one in the room who got it. Mm-hmm. He did get it, who disagreed with originalism. And so I thought that was about as good as it gets. We had protesters who stood up in the room in orange jumpsuits because of Guantanamo. That was the issue of the day. We went around and said, you have to sit down or leave. You can't block the view of others. They sat down or left. He gave his talk. At some point when he was calling on people, a young student, she jumped up and said, why don't you call on a woman? Because he only called on guys. And then he said, okay. And he called on a woman. And it was fine. You know, I mean, people expressed themselves in a way that was honest, but that allowed for the conversation or debate to continue. I think that's to me a great model. It's not always possible, but, you know, at Wesleyan, I think we have developed a culture where people can be, they may be angry that we've invited, you know, Roth to come and speak or Schmidt to come and speak or whomever, but they have so far, knock on wood, they haven't forced us to cancel any events. If they did, we would discipline those students. It's very clear to them that that's against our rules and we enforce our rules. And that's a really important rule because obviously if you keep from someone from being heard, you're really undermining the whole educational project.
Yeah. So why do so many colleges get this wrong? I mean, again, they could be outliers, but many people in my audience will have seen video after video of essentially an effective use of the heckler's veto, right? I mean, the students stand up and they simply don't let the event proceed. And, you know, one fear is that nothing happened to these students. Again, there are certain cases we know of that the students have won awards for their bravery and activism. You know, you did just implicitly at least sketch out what the rules are. I don't know if there's more to say that explicitly there that are kind of bright lines around how to protest and what's acceptable. But why do so many colleges fail to enforce these rules if they have them or fail to have these rules in the first place?
You know, I think that scale matters a great deal. Wesleyan is a small place. The protesters know me. It doesn't mean they like me, but they know me. I know them. I mean, there's a kind of human element there that makes the level of nastiness less intense, I think, than what I've seen. I've seen those same videos, and many of them are at larger places where people don't have a stake in the culture of the institution. The protesters that I've encountered at Wesleyan actually care about Wesleyan. I mean, they think I'm screwing it up or someone else is screwing it up. That's why they're protesting. But they actually care about the institution functions well. But they have a different idea about that, how that should work than I do. But they have that sense of commitment. I think at many schools, especially larger schools, that's just harder because the people are more anonymous vis-a-vis one another. And so they don't have a stake in the operations of the institution. I think the cultivating a culture of respect and respect for protest and respect for one another is something that takes time, and we work at it. I think a lot of schools get it right. It's that old story. Like you don't see lots of videos of places that aren't on fire. You see the fire, right? And so I don't want to minimize it because I think that it is really troubling, especially at institutions that have been taught to respect. You know, when you have a law school where they don't allow someone to speak, that seems to me a tremendous problem. And I don't understand why disciplinary measures aren't taken. I don't have all the facts, so I don't want to, but it does seem to me odd. that if you say that here's the line in the sand and people cross it, that you don't do anything. Now, at Wesleyan, we did have an encampment which broke some of our rules. I mean, we're supposed to register to have tents and things like that. But the people who were protesting, and they were angry and they were really protesting on behalf of Palestinian rights, they were careful not to block entrances, not to take over territory. Everything was porous. People could walk in and out. They didn't disrupt classes, or they didn't make noise late at night. I mean, they didn't disrupt the operations of the university. And at some point, when a very small number of protesters did disrupt the operations or attempted to, then we told them they would be suspended or arrested, and they moved back from that precipice. I think they wanted to see that we would really do it, and we would really do it. But I think it's very important that the people have been given the space to protest and get their views heard, but not at the expense of the educational mission of the institution.
So what was your experience? Now we're going to the houses on fire videos, essentially. What was your experience post-October 7th as a college president watching? I mean, you just described how things unfolded on your campus, but obviously things were worse elsewhere. When you look at a place like Columbia, do you think things were worse simply because of, as you said, the implications of scale, or, you know, being in a community where lots of people who are not even part of the college can just come onto campus and start shrieking? I mean, how much was that the problem, and how much was it just a actual failure of the institution to respond in a way that you would have responded?
Well, I don't want to pretend to know how I would have managed the Columbia situation. You know, I've spent my life at small places, so I don't want to sound as if I have all the answers for these other kind of institutions. In my case, on October 7th, as I got the news about the massacres in Israel, my first decision was about what to say about it at the time. And I've been keeping a blog at Wesleyan since I started as president, since 2007. And I often comment on horrible things that happen in the world. Not all of those things, of course, but things that I feel I have something to say about. And on that day, I did write something. I think the title was Sickening Violence, and posted it on October 7th. And over the next few weeks, wrote several pieces, short pieces, for the Wesleyan World, you know, on a blog. It's public, but doesn't have enormous readership beyond the university. And also wanted to make sure that I called out Islamophobia and things that might happen on campus as a result of this, and try to be a voice that was constructive within our community. I think at many other places, the initial failure was a failure to express outrage at this disgusting pogrom that was coded by some people as part of the struggle for liberation, which I did think at the time would be make clear how stupid that viewpoint is, actually. That if when you have an oppressed model, then the person being oppressed could do anything and it's okay because it's in the service of liberation. That's just an idiotic, immoral view of the world. But I learned over the last couple of years, lots of people who I actually thought were more respectable actually have that view. And that was a sad discovery on my part. Maybe I should have realized it earlier. But at the same time, I wanted to acknowledge that those who were advocating for Palestinian rights, and especially as the war in Gaza got more and more intense, that those were people who had legitimate political and moral concerns that should be heard. And so we tried to create an atmosphere where people could talk about these things in public without it becoming merely performative or let alone violent. And I think on the whole, we succeeded. Lots of schools did. I think the vast majority of schools succeeded in this regard. I mean, there's probably a dozen places where things really get out of hand, from, you know, from Columbia to Chicago to UCLA. I mean, there are, you know, and several others, but there were protests all over the country that stayed within the bounds of, I think, expressing moral outrage at the massacre of civilians. And I think that that was not the headline. The headline is where it where things got out of hand. And I think
I would say, I mean, so yeah, certainly one headline, the most easily understood headline is where things got out of hand. But the other headline is that so much of the outrage that you think can be legitimately voiced on a college campus is still a tissue of moral confusion and lies in many respects, which reveals an ambient level of anti-Semitism in the progressive community that fairly shocked even those of us who have spent a lot of time thinking about anti-Semitism, right? I mean, just the people, you know, I have a lot of things I could say about a 20-year-old who thinks that words are violence, but somehow Hamas is on the right side of history. But, I'm pretty sure there's a depth of moral confusion there that is fairly hard to untangle and worth worrying about, certainly when you're talking about people who are, this is a problem of the left, but over on the right, we've got the most popular podcasters on earth platforming people who are just asking questions about the Holocaust. Wherever you go on the political spectrum, if you move far enough left or far enough right, you are guaranteed to meet anti-Semites. And many of us, certainly in my generation, felt that a real concern about anti-Semitism, certainly in America, was an anachronism. This is in the rearview mirror. We can understand the history. We should understand the history, but this is not a problem for me, and it won't be a problem for my daughters. I don't think I can say that now in the aftermath of October 8th, certainly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that for me, this was really interesting. I mean, I've met a lot of people who have your point of view, and that surprised me, actually. I have always thought that ambient anti-Semitism was exactly that. It was going to be ambient. When all you need to do is scratch in the right direction, and you're going to get anti-Semites coming out.
So you weren't surprised by the amount of anti-Semitism that you saw on the left in the aftermath of October 7th?
Not really. I do think that, I mean, you have this, the moral confusion, I think is a good term, but you have people like in my generation who were taught to believe that the IDF is the most moral armed force in the world. And this was there are sophisticated people who, I'm 68 or in my generation, who look at me in a straight face and say there was an empty land for a people without a land. You know, this kind of talk about stupidity and moral confusion. I was taught this, between those ages of 4 and 14, And so it's a lot of people still have that in their heads. So you have that kind of moral confusion. And mm-hmm. then people on the left who feel that there is a kind of a like colonialist, anti-colonialist dichotomy in the world. They hate all binaries except that one. And then you could actually hate Jews because they're on the colonial side. And I guess I don't think I was surprised. I don't want to sound like I had so much insight in advance. I expect a lot of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. What surprised me were young Jewish kids who grew up in very Jewish neighborhoods who said they were shocked by anti-Semitism. And also the divide between generations. In other words, Jewish progressives, some of whom are observant, or some of whom are Israeli, who really are so antagonistic to any form of constructive Zionist critique. In other words, they just don't want to hear anything about the Jews having a home in the Middle East. And I find that did surprise me. That so my daughter is in her late 20s, and when we were first talking about this, she said something to me like, "I don't know if Israel has a right to exist." Now she is more outwardly Jewish, more observant than I, and so there's she's proud to be Jewish, but for her, Israel is Netanyahu. I mean, she's 28, and for me, Israel is 67 and 73. It's a different, and so I that surprised me. I didn't realize how many young Jews were not going to call out anti-Semitism because they had such a moral revulsion against Israel. And I don't know what, I'm still find that very painful, actually, to think through. Because, I just wrote this piece in the last week or two in Time magazine about Jewish traditions that are critical of the way Israel is conducting this war. But in that piece, I also say, you know, I've always been a constructive supporter or critical supporter of Israel. I do think Jews belong in the Middle East, you know. And so it was when my other kid said to me, you're going to piss off everybody with this thing you wrote. Because on the one hand, it's very critical of the Israeli war machine and the way Netanyahu is using it to stay in power. On the other hand, you know, I think this is Hamas is starving its own people for public relations effect. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those things can be true, actually, alas. And yep. But I am able to say that as a college president and as a college professor and stand in front of a room of 22-year-olds, many of whom will disagree with me. And I can teach Aristotle or I can teach, Jane Austen, and it was fun. We can get along. And I think as it should be.
Well, what about the perception of a double standard that attests to an animus against Jews that really doesn't exist against any other minority group? One of the most galling thing about the testimony of the college presidents that provoked such scrutiny and backlash was not so much their not being able to clearly state that, you know, calling for genocide is in violation of the rules of their university, right? Like that's, I mean, because I do think I'm happy to let them split hairs and default to freedom of speech and to err on the side of literally any ideas being fit for discussion in a college seminar. But what was obvious was that given the nature of the protests at the time, there's simply no way those protests could have continued, would have continued for even a day had you had mobs effectively chanting for, you know, the deaths of Black people or trans people, or you're celebrating people who had just killed Black people or trans people, right? If, you know, Dylann Roof, murders nine Black people in a church. And if you had a mob in the Harvard Quad the next day, you know, shouting in favor of Dylann Roof, those kids would have been expelled, right? I mean, like, there's no way that would have gone on for weeks. And so it was the double standard that everyone found so galling, not that we can't spend a lot of time getting the fine print right around what can actually be said or entertained on a college campus. I'm wondering how you viewed that moment.
Well, I don't think there were great examples of a quad filled with people on October 8th chanting in favor of Hamas. There were some, I think,
idiotic social media posts. Well, you had 32 organizations at Harvard who came out in favor of Hamas on October 8th before Israel had done anything in response and accused Israel of genocide. And bringing all the violence. I mean, basically, the onus was entirely on Israel, and we had, you know, lionized Hamas, hang glider pilots in the logo of some of these organizations.
Well, I know those examples, and I find them reprehensible. And I watched that. I happened to turn on the hearings, which because I was going to be on MSNBC that night, and I thought I should know what I'm talking about And I thought it was incredibly chilling. I mean, I thought it was just horrible. And just as you say, I mean, the splitting hairs, which you would never do with any other group. I mean, and it was for me also horrible that, you know, a person in Congress who has championed or at least allowed for the championing of replacement theory, which is, you know, showing that she's somehow a defender of the Jews.
You're talking about Elise Stefanik?
Yeah. To me, it was just horrific. A show trial in which the presidents just fell apart. So I thought it was awful. And I've said that again and again. But I have to say, Sam, you know, that we're right now, we have an assault on civil society that is being engineered by the federal government to include universities, journalists, law firms, coming for your favorite entertainment company, if they haven't gotten them already. And I'm not sure why we're talking about the three presidents, only one of whom remains a president. Right. Now, right now, you have this, I mean, you had some stupid stuff, for sure, going on in colleges and universities, protests that were dumb, got out of hand, people who identify with what they think of as radicals and they're identifying with murderers. Oh, I think that's true, but right now, that has been being used by the government for extortion in colleges, universities, law firms, who knows what's coming next. I mean, this is And I worry not only about the assault itself, but how Jews are being played in this. And we were played by Elise Stefanik, and now we're being played by Trump. We're being played as he's going to be the defender of the Jews. And I think it's a terrible mistake for us to accept that protection. And I think it's a misdirection of our attention to think that the real issue is that you had some idiotic protesters at Harvard, rather than you have a federal government that's putting all its forces to bring to heel colleges, universities around the country. You have idiotic college students protesting. You know, that's not news. That happens. That doesn't define colleges and universities, certainly, and especially those schools where, as you know, I mean, the Jewish life continues with great gusto at those schools, despite the idiotic attacks on or defenses of Hamas and terrorism.
Yeah, so let's talk about the response. Do you view this, the actions of the Trump administration, as entirely insincere and merely a pretext for creeping authoritarian control of elite institutions? Or do you think it's a mixture of a sincere response to the perceived problem we've been discussing and an actual intention to rout out anti-Semitism in higher education, but it's mingled with, you know, all of the corruption and self-dealing and, you know, authoritarian intuitions of Trump and his enablers?
I think the assault on universities has as much to do with anti-Semitism as the Trump coin does in the crypto market with anti-Semitism. I mean, I think it's a total fabrication. I mean, the idea that Trump's cronies are going to tell the Jewish president of Harvard or the Jewish president of Harvard Law School, dean of Harvard Law School, how to protect Jews or a UCLA. I mean, there's been no finding of facts. They're not interested in actually who was harmed. You see that you might have seen the story today in the New York Times or perhaps it was the Chronicle of Higher Education. I think it was the Chronicle of Higher Education about the Jews at Columbia who were applying for money because if they were victims of anti-Semitism. And now you have these pro-Palestinian Jews who are going to apply for money from the settlement because they say they were called self-hating Jews. But I mean, it's just kind of craziness.
Talk about unintended consequences.
Exactly. I do think the intention here, as Chris Rufo has stated and as Trump's other folks have stated, is to get ideological control. And it's not just universities. It's the military. It's law firms. This is attacking civil society, by which I mean those parts of our culture in which there are institutions that have sources of legitimacy. They're independent of the ideology of the leader. And that's one of the great things about America that conservatives has always underscored, that our freedom depends on these pockets of autonomy that we have. It could be universities, it could be libraries, it could be the Boy Scouts, you know, and that we don't all have to conform to the ideology of the leader. And I think that in the current regime, this is really about control, power, creating obsequiousness as a sign of loyalty. That's what this is about. It's not about getting more people to feel comfortable going to Shabbat dinner. They feel fine going to Shabbat dinner at these schools.
Well, what specifically is the administration doing that most worries you?
Well, I think the attempt to impose extraordinary fines on schools so as to ensure that those schools have access to research dollars is making sure that the schools line up to do research only on those topics that will be, as the messages say, in accord with the priorities of the president. I mean, when you get a grant canceled these days from Washington, it says your project is no longer aligned with the goals of the president. And so, you know, whether it's the RNA vaccines or whatever it's going to be, that you will no longer do research because the president doesn't think it's appropriate. And I think what will happen is that you'll have the normalization of chilled speech, which is what people who were critical of wokeness were always worried about, is you get a normalization of a shrunken free speech area. And I think this is, you know, the power of the government to do that is so intense that you know, if you write an op-ed, you can get deported, or if you are seen as protesting, you can't get a job. These are, I think, really worrisome attempts to control institutions that have traditionally had sources of autonomous legitimacy. And I think it's a symptom of this authoritarianism. I mean, a more trivial example would be, you know, the Kennedy honors that the president wants to take mm-hmm. over himself. Much less trivial would be trying to make sure the Smithsonian only exhibits things that are in accord with the priorities of the administration. I mean, that is extraordinary. And it has already become something that we have to accept.
Take the Smithsonian example, right? So, I mean, I think there's going to be no daylight between us in our criticism of Trump and Trumpism and all of the political and cultic intuitions that inform everything they're doing. So, I mean, we're on the same page there. But, I mean, take something like the Smithsonian. I mean, that's an institution. I'm not in contact with all the details, but that's an institution that clearly had drunk a fair amount of the Kool-Aid of wokeness. I mean, I remember at one point there was they put out something about the very notion, I think this was the Smithsonian, the very notion of objectivity in mathematics was racism, right? Racially coded, right?
I know what you mean, but I don't think that was the Smithsonian.
I think it was, someone can fact check us, but if it wasn't the Smithsonian, it was close enough, right? I mean, it was, and like the idea of punctuality, the idea of there being an objective answer to a math question, there was a list of things that were just like normal intellectual hygiene, which were coded as basically white supremacy, according to this organization. Okay, that's just, at a minimum, the gaslighting of a whole society, if not the self-immolation of a very expensive and important institution. Imagine for a moment, you know, Trump is replaced by someone who ostensibly has all the same concerns about the left-wing capture of our institutions, but who's actually a decent human being who loves the Constitution and wants to do something useful. What would or could the government do at this moment that could be useful to course correct?
Sure. I think it's you need an affirmative action program for conservatives in those mm-hmm. institutions I think the Smithsonian would be an interesting case. I worked very closely with the Library of Congress years ago, and the Librarian of Congress at the time, James Billington, was certainly not a radical of any sort. And there was a kind of that you once could feel the ideology of the leader in some small ways, but it gets filtered through the professional staff, the curators, the historians. Now, if all the professional staff comes from the same ideological mold, then you're going to be missing the friction and the debate that makes these places great, you know? And so we just need more conservative and religious voices within those institutions, but you need them to be there as professionals, as historians. You don't want, just like nobody wants the Bureau of Labor Statistics to only give good data for right. the person in power. That's like the mirror image of the idea that a math answer is racist if you don't get it right and you're not a white person. Those are both idiotic things. But I think that getting more voices, the traditional liberal solution, right? Getting more voices into the mix mm-hmm. so that we have a better chance of having a broader inquiry that leads to good answers that will lead to new questions. I mean, that's what we need. And I think most educational institutions still believe that. They need to practice it more consistently. Mm. And that means inviting people into the conversation whose views will be surprising. And now someone will say, well, you want to invite a Nazi? They're surprised. No. I mean, there will be limits on this. We don't invite the flat earther into the geography department. But you do invite people with different methodologies and different claims on truth and have that debate. I think that happens less from the top, let's say the politician or the president of the university, than making sure that you have the range of voices that can be listened to respectfully in ways that generate good questions for further research. That's what one wants in these cultural institutions. It seems to me that in most colleges and universities, the workaday teacher and student is actually doing just that. They're reading a range of texts. They're debating a range of ideas. Sure, John Haidt and others have they've pointed out that at times that range is shrunk because, like on social media, I'm going to say, "Oh, Sam Harris, he's a racist," because you know, and then maybe you won't speak up next time. I mean, that's a problem, but that's a problem you deal with as a teacher by helping students broaden their concerns so that they have a better chance of finding better answers to the questions that concern them.
So, which colleges or other institutions have stood up well so far to this pressure, and which have capitulated? Can you talk about success and failure at this point, or is the has the other shoe not dropped on any of these cases?
It's still, I think there's still early innings. You know, I have my differences with Chris Eisgruber at Princeton, who's the president there. We don't always see this eye to eye, which is a good thing. But I've admired his sense, to my mind, sensible objections to government intrusion into scientific research. And it's not as if Princeton is a perfect institution where people have behaved, but that these institutions are supposed to be self-correcting and not controlled by the government. Pat McGuire is the president of a small Catholic women's college in Washington, Trinity College, has been very forthright in her objections to government intrusion. And, you know, her students are mostly going into health professions there, it's not a Harvard or a Stanford where people just aspire to Wall Street. There's a guy named Mike Gavin at Delta College in Michigan. It's a community college. He's organized a whole bunch of community colleges and their leaders. Those are folks who are educating mostly working class people, mostly for vocational things, but with a broader context for the vocation they're learning. And those folks really need government support to keep the doors open, but they don't need ideological advice from the federal government. You know, when you're studying, whether it's welding or auto mechanics or history or literature at a community college, you don't need the government telling you how to run those classes. So I think that the effort to please the government before they come down on you is, for me, a frightening form of tyranny. I think colleges and universities should be critical of the government. They should be loyal to the country, but critical of whoever's in power, and offer at least a platform for people to be critical. And I think that what worries me right now is that these threats that one reads about at wealthy schools like Harvard or at public institutions like UCLA, it puts the fear of God into people who are leading these institutions, especially if you have a hospital. Because if you get the funding cut off, people are not going to get their medication. They're not going to. That's a huge responsibility, and so I understand why these are people. Probably they may be to the left of me. But they don't want to risk their institution's well-being. I worry about the country's well-being. I want my grandchildren to be able to go to a college or university and be able to speak their mind and not have to worry about what the government thinks they should think. And so that's why I feel it's really important for people in my kind of position or people in law firms or people who are in communications to remind our friends and our listeners or fellow citizens that if you live in a democracy, the government doesn't get to tell you what to do, except in extraordinary cases, like how fast your car should go or, you know, how to make sure the water you get is clean. But they shouldn't tell you what to believe or how to think.
What do you think about the relationship between elite institutions, in particular, you know, higher education, and the rest of the country that doesn't perceive that they have any stake in them? I mean, there's a lot of people who support Trump and really see nothing to criticize in what he's doing here. I mean, leaving Jews and the problem of anti-Semitism aside, something like half the country is just happy to see Trump hammer these elitist, you know, factories of wokeness. I mean, they view them as, in some cases, understandably, as kind of, you know, gatekeepers to a status industrial complex, more than the places where the best and brightest are going to learn how to contribute knowledge to necessary disciplines, right? I mean, there's a lot that's learned in a university that many people, in some cases, rightly criticize. I mean, if you try to read a page of Judith Butler, you might wonder what the hell is going on in any of these colleges. But it seems to me that there's a problem when half the society or something like half the society feels like there's nothing to support in these institutions because they're corrupt and on some level unnecessary. And I've forgotten what percentage of Americans get college educations in the first place, but
less than half. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a majority. So, I mean, is there any kind of cultural reset we can hope for or seek to engineer here?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I do think that the elite schools have found themselves just being elitist schools. You know, that is that their privileges are unearned. The system is rigged. Now, it's not, I think that, and Judith is a friend of mine, so I'm not going to pick on her, but or them, I guess.
My apologies.
Now. But that's okay.
I stand by the textual criticism, however.
That's fair enough. But, yeah. But, you know, most Americans, and I would myself included, don't really understand calculus very well. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have calculus, right? Yeah. Or quantum computing. I mean, but the difference is that, but most Americans can't catch a football like an elite wide receiver, or can't do the work of a Navy SEAL the way a Navy SEAL does the work, because we can't. They're just exceptional people doing exceptional things. And when we admire exceptional people doing exceptional things, when we believe they've earned that or that capacity, or that they can do things that we are invited to admire. I think what has happened in many colleges and universities is that we've taught our students how to be condescending rather than how to be engaged with their fellow neighbors. And I think David Brooks has written powerfully about this recently, about how colleges and universities have contributed to the segregation of cultures in this country, so that, you know, people who go to these selective schools, they marry each other, they live together, they give their own children lots of opportunities at the expense of other people.
Ironically, Charles Murray has been on this topic for quite some time.
And there are a range of people who have really made the point again and again that higher education in the United States works best when it invites the citizenry in, when it actually engages with the public sphere. And I think that colleges and universities should do a much better job of contributing to civic renewal. And this is not about Trump. I'm part of an organization at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, which used to be the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. And they really are committed to trying to get colleges and universities over the long haul to contribute to civic renewal, and not just to like gatekeeping, you know, or filtering, which is not something that will engender respect or support from our fellow citizens. So I work also with a group called the National Educational Equity Foundation, and we offer college credit-bearing courses for free to high schools, high-poverty high schools, Title I high schools. And we're working on a civics course for those schools, because I think it's really important that we not just give people an economics course or a psychology course, but we actually give people a sense of how does the American government work? What are our conceptions of freedom? How have they evolved? And that we actually do that in a way that's for everyone, anyone who's going to a high school in America. And I think more colleges and universities should define themselves by how many people they positively affect rather than how many people they reject. Mm-hmm. Michael Crow has made this argument at Arizona for a long time, you know, that we should not just celebrate the schools that reject the most people. We should celebrate the institutions that positively impact the most people.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott Galloway has been great on that point for years.
Yeah.
Okay, so finally, Michael, we're coming to the end of our hour here, and I've got a lateral move to a closing question. What are your thoughts on artificial intelligence? How is it affecting education?
And, oy vey, that's such an easy question at the end.
And I mean, many people are worried that there are whole college majors that are soon to be vestigial because of the progress being made here. I mean, it's been a long time since I've heard anyone say learn to code. You know, somewhat ironically, the first disciplines here that are vulnerable are not necessarily what anyone expected.
Right.
You know, I think computer science is among the most vulnerable. How do you perceive the looming change here?
So it scares the hell out of me, but I'm trying to be optimistic and say, okay, how am I going to use this as a teacher? So in 2 weeks, I'm teaching my virtue advice class, and I have them always writing every week a response to, let's say, first week Confucius, next week Aristotle, next week Aquinas, you know, and we march along from the ancient world to the present. And of course, they can now get those responses from an AI bot. So I'm going to have them write their exams in class. So that in that sense, I'm adjusting to like kind of playing defense against AI. They're going to have to do it right there in class. On the other hand, I'm actually asking them to engage with an AI, a large language model, and have conversations with the AI about the virtue that each week they're going to be practicing. So they practice temperance for a week. And at the end of that week, they meet with other students and talk about their practice of temperance or chastity or orderliness. But before they go to meet with the students, I want them to be in conversation with an AI bot about that practice of virtue and to talk with the artificial intelligence system about what is its understanding of a practice of virtue. And I, of course, each of them will get different answers. So I'm trying to actually embrace what I can. I mean, I'm an old guy. I have, you know, I'm used to doing things a certain way, but also to make sure that they don't lose the opportunity to think for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote this book, The Student, A Short History. And at the end, I say the whole point of being a student is to learn how to think for yourself in the company of others. And if you just outsource thinking to a machine, you lose the opportunity for enormous pleasure, but also, I think, freedom. And so I want to invite them in to learn to think for themselves with these great texts, you know, and we go to Machiavelli and then to Montesquieu and then Jane Austen. You know, it's not just thinking alone, thinking with some of these great, powerful writers and thinkers, and then talking about it with others. I think AI could be part of the conversation rather than the place you outsource your thinking to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that sounds like a good way of splitting it up. I mean, I think you want to be able to assess somebody's capacity for thought in a way that is can't be gamed by, you know, cheating with it with AI. But yeah, you also can't deny the utility of the growing utility of the technology, right? I mean, this is as bad as it's ever going
to
be.
I asked them, ChatGPT, what are you likely to ask? What's Sam Harris likely to ask me? You didn't ask
how
me
did,
anything.
How did it do?
You know, it wasn't surprising, but. So I have used it, and it's given me hallucinations that it got me in trouble, actually. I wrote a piece for The Times where it gave me a false quotation, and the copy editor, thank God, said, where is this from? And I kept looking for it, and I realized I'd gotten it from Chad, and I asked, is this really a quotation? It said, oh, no, but it's close. And I realized, you know, checked the
work. Well, it's bad. I can confirm it's bad because I went and asked, there was a quote I've been using, and I forgot its origin. But I've been using it a fair amount, and I asked, so who is the source of this quote? And it said that I was. And I said, no, I can assure you, Sam Harris is not the source of this quote. And I said, oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, well, buyer beware on that front.
Yes,
at least
absolutely.
For some considerable time yet. Well, Michael, it's been great to get you here and get your expertise and your perspective on this issue that is not going away. I think we've got 3 long years ahead of us to see.
Yeah.
How the institutions hold up under the pressure of Trump and Trumpism.
I think if what will, for me, a great outcome of this horrible situation would be that more Americans learn to value the freedoms that we've been taking for granted. I mean, my speeches with parents, they say to me, where do you find the courage to speak up? And I say, what? Listen to us in America, you know, why do you need courage to speak up? And I think, that's a great thing that we haven't had to have to be brave to speak up and to remind our students and our colleagues of these freedoms and how important it is to protect them. I think that would be a good outcome.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
A pleasure.